Hello, Loyal Sea Control listener. This is Matt Hipple, your host. Before we start the podcast, I wanted to note some changes that have occurred since recording on the 19th of December. In today's show, we talk about African instability. Our guest, Zach Elkheim, mentioned that he thought South Sudan would be the next country to collapse into chaos, based on increasing levels of violence during the week, inspired by a coup attempt on the 16th, in which the former vice president, Riek Machar, was implicated. Riek Machar initially denied involvement with the rebels, but did praise them, and on Thursday the 17th requested the ruling party and army remove President Salva Kiir from office. Yesterday, Sunday the 22nd, Riek Machar declared himself in open rebellion and claimed to be in control of the western state of Jonglei and the major oil-producing state of Unity. A spokesman for South Sudan's military confirmed that the government had lost control of both state capitals, though, as an editorial note, that does not necessarily mean the rebels control the states themselves. In both cases, it appears that the military commanders and government officials of each capital had defected. It should be noted that on Saturday, three CV-22 Ospreys approached Bor, capital of Jonglei, in order to evacuate U.S. personnel. They were attacked on their way in, and four service members were injured. Those aircraft rerouted to Uganda. According to statements by the DoD, the U.S. has since successfully evacuated about 380 Americans and 300 citizens of other nations to Nairobi and other locations on four chartered flights and five military aircraft. Unfortunately, our guest appears to have been absolutely right, and another country is added to the list of trouble regions we discussed. With that in mind, I now return you to the regularly scheduled podcast.
Welcome to another edition of Sea Control, your holiday moment of PowerPoint recap from the Center for International Maritime Security. This week, Matt Hipple is joined by Zach Elkheim and friend of the show, James Bridger, to talk about rebellions in the Central African Republic, Mali, and Nigeria, as well as the future prospects for Somalia. Remember to subscribe on iTunes and Stitcher Stream Radio. Leave a rating and a comment. We think Sea Control is a very fine product, and anyone who says otherwise is planning to lock you out in the snow. Now, sit back and enjoy the show.
Welcome to another edition of Sea Control, your moment of PowerPoint rehab from the Center for International Maritime Security. While it may be Christmas and everyone is on vacation, Santa Claus is a fiction maintained by the stability of the global market. So we're all here still bringing you the insights you need on maritime security. Now, some of you may assume, oh, it's Christmas. Here's a podcast. They're going to talk about security in the Arctic. Wrong. That's cliche, and it would offend both you and me. So we decided to bring you a bit of mind over matter for the cold weather. I'm joined again by James Bridger, and for the first time, his friend and associate, Zach Elkheim. We're going to talk about African security issues today, maritime security, land security, because they're all intertwined. Again, nothing gets onto the sea lanes unless it's built on land, and if the land is in turmoil, nothing gets traded. So we're going to talk about all those issues today. Welcome, guys, to the podcast. Thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having me back, Matt.
Perfect. Now, Jim and Zach, if you could, go ahead and introduce yourselves as we always do. Frame for the audience kind of your background, what your interests are, and where you're coming from.
James, why don't you go first, mate?
All right. My name is James Bridger. I'm a maritime security consultant with Delex Systems in Herndon, Virginia. My area of expertise and focus is on African maritime security, primarily piracy in East and West Africa, as well as international trafficking and smuggling through maritime routes and asymmetric maritime conflict writ large.
Zach?
I'm Zach Elkheim. I'm a sub-Saharan African researcher at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. I'm primarily interested in security and counterterrorism in sub-Saharan Africa, focused primarily on Nigeria and Somalia, but I kind of run the gamut for what's going on all across the continent.
Perfect. Gentlemen, we're going to start off with today a topic that a lot of folks have been following in the periphery, maybe not getting into the weeds on, is the Central African Republic. Those who have been at least partially paying attention know that there's a lot of upheaval. There's an issue with the government being in a state of turmoil, who the legitimate power is now. A good thing to remember, I suppose, in this Christmas season when we're all getting together with our families, that folks are out there and life can be really hard for them. Zach, you're the ground guy. Frame for us a little bit what's happening in the Central African Republic and how it's being affected or affecting the countries around it.
Sure. Well, Central African Republic, since its independence from France, has been described as a phantom state. There's not much government institutions, and it's been a total mess, one bad government after another.
Didn't one of the original presidents think that he was the reincarnation of Napoleon? Or was
he did.
It
renamed the country the Central African Empire and had a very Napoleonic inauguration ceremony. He had lions in the ceremony, gold, and was basically bankrupting France to keep himself in power.
So we're already starting off from a great foundation.
Right, exactly. And historically, France has kept about 400 troops there, mostly to maintain mineral resources that CAR has a lot of. It's a small population, a poor population, about 80% Christian, 20% Muslim. And the last president, the one before the current president, Michael Djotodio, was kicked out by what has become to be known as the Seleka rebels. And they are majority Muslim and aided by a bunch of militias from Sudan and Chad. It's a bit of a mess, essentially.
How did these rebels from Chad and the Sudan get involved in the Central African Republic?
Well, I mean, there's Janjaweed from Sudan who are basically always up for it. And these countries, Sudan and Chad, would quite frankly rather fight in other countries than their own, sort of releasing some pressure, let some of the people, malcontents, go and fight elsewhere. The thing that it's done to the Central African Republic is that for the first time, they have a Muslim president, and the Christian minorities felt like they are in trouble, being put upon. And while it isn't necessarily as clear-cut as Christian versus Muslim, there are some major instances of Christians killing Muslims and Muslims killing Christians. And in the last 2 days, when the anti-government troops killed 60 of the Seleka troops, the government responded by killing 1,000 Christians.
Now, maybe you can clarify something for me. You're using the term government and anti-government.
Sure.
When you say government, then, you're referencing the government that's put in place by the Seleka rebels. So the Seleka rebels, the government was overthrown, and now you're referring to them as... I'm trying to get our terms correct at the beginning, because if they were rebels and now they're the government, aren't they technically anti-government? Are there any, I suppose, does the previous president have any forces left in the country?
Yeah.
Is there still a battle between the two?
So that's a really relevant point to bring up. So the Seleka rebels are the current power, the current governing power in the country. There is another militia made up of forces loyal to the previous administration that are called the anti-Balaka movement, which literally means the anti-machete movement. And they are mostly Christian and fighting against the Muslims, to paraphrase and make it overly simple.
You say the anti-machete movement. Is that a specific allusion to genocides like Rwanda? I think, at least in the West, it's an image that we use for what happens during these genocides. Are they referencing that as a statement about what they stand for and what they think about the Seleka rebels?
I think they are, and I think they're trying to make a point to the people and gain support for themselves that we're not going to allow, you know, any minorities to brutalize you poor civilians, and kind of use that as a coalescing fact to gather public support around them.
You said there were 400 French troops in the Central African Republic. What's their engagement, if any, in what's happening right now?
Okay, so the French were there with about 400 troops at the beginning of this conflict. That they increased that originally to 1,200, now 1,600, and they were mostly guarding French interests, the mining resources. Now they're the only real force on the ground. They've been disarming anyone with weapons that they see, but they've sold it to the public. The French have sold it to their own public, as this will only be for 6 months. There's no way it'll be for 6 months. They tried to do the same thing in Mali, and they're still there. They simply can't get out. They've been really assertive in Africa and leading a lot of people to think that it's an unwitting return to Francafrique, France.
Now, what are their interests? Why are they there? I know this is part of the former Francophone, I guess I suppose it still is Francophone Africa. Mm-hmm. But what are the interests that they're defending there now, and why is it that they can't, if they so desired, why couldn't they leave?
Well, I mean, first and foremost, their resources. When those troops were there, they were guarding resources that belonged to French companies. So that is a major impetus for them staying there. Parallels to Mali with the uranium mines. So there's that. But they also don't want this interrupting free trade throughout Africa, because France, in French-speaking Africa, is the major trade partner flow. So it's a very strong economic interest going on here, and has really resulted in France being the most assertive Western power in Africa at the moment.
I'm glad you brought up the issue of the uranium mines. We're going to come back to that. But before we move on, do you have any overall thoughts? Give us a framing, if you will, as where you see this conflict going.
I think it's going to get worse before it gets better. There's also sort of a lack of commitment from any other force in the Western force to get involved. America is certainly willing to provide African troops, but these troops aren't necessarily well equipped to do anything, and that's where it's so important. So the United States is flying in Burundian troops as we speak, but there are no democratic institutions in this country. So it might calm down for a while, but this is just going to be a rinse repeat for the foreseeable future unless something changes.
You mentioned Burundi. How are these other African? Is this going to become, do you think, an AU effort, an African Union kind of like in Somalia, or do you foresee this being very piecemeal?
I think it will be AU. The AU wants to assert itself. The EU wants to keep out of it. And the European nations don't want to spend the money on a UN peacekeeping mission. So I do think it'll be AU. The much thrown around African solution to African problems is going to get brought up ad nauseum. And it will be AU, but the different soldiers have different levels of professional fighting. There are some good and more professional soldiers and some less. So it's really rolling the dice on what's going to happen.
Zach, if I can jump in with a question for you here.
Sure.
This time around, has there been any role that South Africa has been playing? I mean, they had peacekeepers who were who were killed during the overthrow of the previous government. You know, withdrew following that, and I was wondering if you've come across them trying to stake out.
South African troops pulled out after Bouazizi's. Go on, no, mate. Sorry, I keep cutting you off. Go on.
No, just that that was it. If they are playing any sort of role this time around in the crisis?
Not at present. They kind of have been tentative to get involved since they lost troops guarding Bouazizi. So I think they're willing to take a back seat and let ECOWAS or further North African countries take the lead.
Regionally then, is there any regional hegemon in Africa, any other state? I mean, we talked about militias from Sudan and Chad. And in terms of regional geopolitics, is there any state interest from Nigeria or, I mean, I guess you've got, you know, everything else is, Sudan's a mess, Libya's a mess. I'm sure Gaddafi would have had his hands in this if he was still alive, but.
No, of course. Look, Nigeria is definitely keeping its eye on it, especially with UN members on the ground saying that they think Boko Haram's involved. Now, whether or not that's established fact or not, who knows? But the president of Nigeria, like Jonathan, is really starting to push for this regional African quick response team. And he might try and push that, but for now I think he's got his hands full with Boko Haram in the north of his own country.
I've got a question about that, actually. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm one of the guys that sees a trend, if you will, a lot of points of connection, a non-virtuous cycle, if you will, between all of these rebellions, all of these militias from the Central African Republic to Somalia to Nigeria. You bring up Boko Haram and the UN observer saying that it's involved. Do you think that in your personal opinion, do you think that's the case, or is this a political case being built for more Western involvement in Africa?
That's a really good question. The simple truth is it's hard to tell. I mean, the borders of Africa are kind of arbitrary, and there are people who live in Nigeria who are tribally closer to people who live in Niger or Cameroon than they are to people who live in the southern part of their own country. So it's certainly possible that they are there. They're definitely in Niger. They're definitely in Cameroon. But CAR might just be a little too far east for them to be operating. Then again, anything's possible because there is so much lack of government and effective military forces.
Who do you think is who would be the most effective player? Who would it be, namely, who would it be best to get involved in this conflict? And who do you think is likely? Because those two people aren't necessarily the same.
Right. Oh, I mean, it goes back to who's prepared to spend the money. Nigeria, under normal circumstances, would love to get involved. They'd love to boost their international prestige and their regional prestige as the major power player in that part of the world. I mean, under normal circumstances, Egypt might have been, happy to get involved and be the peacekeeper as well. These two countries countries have their own problems and are really more interested in sorting their own problems out. So you're going to have to look at countries that haven't necessarily been the main power players to step it up a little bit. The EU is not going to help. I mean, France will have to be there for a little while and train local troops and maybe look to Senegal or Cote d'Ivoire or other sympathetic countries for help. But, I mean, again, those traditional power players are not interested and have their own problems.
So then who do you see as most likely then? I realize I'm kind of asking you to plant a flag, I suppose, as we dance around the topic of who won't get involved. But if you had to put down no, – we're not gambling here. You don't have to put down any money. But if you had to – you already mentioned Burundi's getting involved with the aid of the United States. Who do you see as being the one who's going to say, hey, nobody else is getting involved with this. This is a really bad deal for everybody around this guy. I'm gonna put my cards down on the table.
Was there not talk, Zach, of Tanzanian peacekeepers might deploy, which is rather novel for the country?
That's true.
There were and there are. Yes, there were. Look, ultimately, it goes that it's not a question of which country is going to step up. It's which country is going to get the most out of it. Is France going to make a deal with some country and say, you know what, we'll train your troops from now on and we'll invest significantly in your military infrastructure. And they'll say, okay, you know what, we'll do it and this will be a good training mission for us. So it's just a question of what deals are going on around this. And I'm hesitant to say who at the moment because I've heard the Tanzanians are going to be there, the Burundians are going to be there. Burkina Faso might want to boost its regional prestige and get in there. But at the same time, they don't want to get involved in what is fast becoming very much portrayed as a Christian Muslim issue.
So, what do you see as
sorry to waffle a little bit, but I'm not prepared to answer that because it could be anyone.
Of course, totally understandable. Now, what do you see as the path out, if there is any? Again, hey, there's no money down on the table. It's okay. If you're wrong, no one's going to come after you.
Look. Things are going to be bad. The prevalence of weaponry and violence and lack of democratic institutions mean it's going to be bad for the foreseeable future. What's going to happen? This round of violence will probably play itself out, whether it takes 1 month, 6 months, a year, or 2 years. They'll come to some sort of agreement, and the next round, and it'll happen again. I mean, not to sound cynical, but it's going to keep happening.
Go ahead.
Sorry, this was touched on earlier, but you know, as you said that, you had Janjaweed militias from Sudan, militias from Chad, all involved. I think one of the sort of problems we've had in, we've saw it in West Africa a decade ago, the Great Lakes region now, and now in Central Africa too, is that even when am I in there? Can you?
Yeah, I hear you. Go on.
Even when, you get a UN mission, you get a ceasefire, you get in a disarmament, demobilization, reconstruction, and it's always centered on that one country. But you have, these completely mobile militias that, okay, there's a peace treaty in Darfur, we're off to CAR. Oh, there's this in Chad. And it's basically an entire, generation that's grown up not really knowing anything different than this. And so we keep trying to find, solutions to national problems that are in fact region wide, and we don't seem to be able to look beyond that scope.
And I think you're also dealing with sovereignty issues there. Countries are not willing to let others to upset their population, and it's really difficult. I mean, it's happened in Nigeria where they're very upset with Cameroon because they can't pursue Boko Haram into Cameroon. The one exception was the Lord's Resistance Army, where Ugandan troops were allowed to essentially run across Africa chasing Joseph Kony, and that's only because there was such a well-orchestrated media campaign about who he is and why he's important.
We've talked about the Central African Republic, and we've beaten this topic a little bit to death. I think we're not going to come, of course, and we're not trying to come to the solution, but we get a good view of what's happening there, Zach, from the way you're describing, which is good, which gives us a lot of our listeners and me and Jim, I'm sure, some foundational material to go forward from. But we're talking, Jim just brought up that regional concept. Hey, he's talking about the Great Lakes region. He's talking about regional issues. Let's take a shift over. Let's talk about Boko Haram. Let's talk about the rebellion happening in Mali right now. Again, French involvement. It's a cross-border issue because you've got Boko Haram in Nigeria. They're crossing across into Niger. We talked about the uranium mines in Niger got attacked and a military barracks as well. Fears about terrorism and mines with nuclear material, not weapons grade, of course, or even industrial grade, but still access that might make us take a step back and question what's going on here. Where are we going in Mali? What is going to be the resolution? Of course, asking you to plant a flag, not looking for a solid prediction, but what's the way out here? Because France has been there for a while, and it seems that they've been militarily effective, but it doesn't seem to be getting us anywhere. It seems like we're, to use the cliched phrase, in a bit of a quagmire there.
Absolutely. And I mean, again, it comes from the fact that France wanted to get in and get out. They wanted a quick solution to Mali and have business as usual. When they moved in there, they had no plans to stay there as long as they did. Mali before this violence was looked as the model African democracy. You know, people thought that Mali was as good as it gets for Africa. And if this is as good as it gets for Africa, we're in serious trouble. But they've gotten bogged down. They were willing to not address the serious core issues, how the Tuaregs feel disenfranchised and the south of the country has all the infrastructure. And there is, in fact, you know, lawlessness and Islamists tied to Al-Qaeda in the far north that can wreak havoc if they want. The reason that Islamists got involved in Mali was because the Tuaregs made a deal with them to try and have their own country. And as soon as they managed to get the Malian troops out, they turned on each other. So there are some serious, serious issues that need to be taken care of before anything can change. And going for this quick, fast fix is not going to do it. I mean, one of the stipulations of the peace transitional government last time around was that they had 60 days after the elections to sort out the Tuareg problem, which has been going on for decades.
You know, that's a good thing for people to remember. I think it's lost in the haze of recent news. But that right when that rebellion did occur, there was that moment where there was an obvious split that happened in front of the entire world, is that the Tuaregs came out and they said, hey, we're not associated with Al-Qaeda, we're not terrorists. And then the folks associated with them that had aided them in this process said, oh, wait, take a step back, because, yeah, I totally am Al-Qaeda, and this is going down. So it's interesting to see that this has become that three-way conflict. Why hasn't that fraction between the Tuareg rebels and the militias associated with Al-Qaeda caused more of a strategic collapse on that side? But why hasn't this allowed the Malians and the French together to bring this conflict to a close? Because you would think that this would become a much simpler equation of divide and conquer for the central government in southern Mali.
That's fair on the face of it, but there's a couple of problems with that. One, there are families, Tuareg families, that are on both sides of the Al-Qaeda, MNLA, the Movement for the National Liberation of Azawad, the Tuareg separation group. So this is very much a complicated matter in a complicated region, and if there's anything that they do agree on is they're not going to let these foreigners come and tell them what to do. The second thing is that they've been there for so long. Al-Qaeda has been there for so long. Mukhtar Belmukhtar, who is just designated. So these are people who've invested in the area, and they're not going to leave easily. And if they do get pushed back, they can escape north into south of Algeria, where no one's going to stop them, and they can regroup and come at you again.
I'm surprised. Is Algeria that much of an option for them? Because it appears that they got involved with that attempt to take hostages at the oil facility, and the Algerians came down really hard on that, established a very firm precedence that they would take operational defeat of terrorists over their taking of hostages. They would be able to use the southern Algeria that easily for their purposes?
If not southern Algeria, then Mauritania. If not Mauritania, then Niger. But yes, and also there's a difference between regrouping and, you know, actively pursuing operations. And I think that the Algerians would be prepared to leave them alone if, you know, they did nothing, if they were not violent in Algeria, and they'd be more than happy if they were violent elsewhere, and that's where all the malcontents went.
Now, how do you see this fitting into a regional context? We talked about Boko Haram's involvement in both Mali and Nigeria. I guess this is a silly, simplified question, but to frame it for us, chicken or egg, who came first? Do you think that Boko Haram, it obviously has been pushing ahead since before this this rebellion in Mali. Do you see one as having a greater effect on the other? Is Boko Haram's ability to move somewhat freely in northern Nigeria, has that inspired this separation in Mali, sort of a collapsing of dominoes, if you will, of regional instability? What's the trend that you see there happening?
Sure. Well, there's a couple of different trends. I mean, Boko Haram is the latest manifestation of a problem that's been going on in Nigeria for over 100 years. In the 1890s, there was problems with various types of Islam in northern Nigeria. In the 1970s and early 80s, there was a Islamist-styled uprising in Nigeria, and this is the latest manifestation. Now, the problem is that it's fed into the growth of Al-Qaeda ideology and Wahhabi Islam, and it's very attractive to these people who feel very sidelined through the traditional Islamic way of life. Add that to the fact that you have Al-Qaeda in Mali, in Mauritania, and they're able to train with each other and feed off each other and learn from each other, and it's a huge problem. And compound that with the fact that if they fight a state which they don't believe in, they can escape across borders, whereas their pursuers simply cannot because of obviously territorial boundaries.
To push this a little further, Admiral Stavridis came out in May this year with an article in the Washington Post called The Dark Side of Globalization. And his point was talking about the ability of these terrorist and criminal networks to network as easily as normal legal operations do, commercially and militarily. How close do you see Boko Haram and the rebels in Mali coming together? Because it seems like it's for them becoming a virtuous cycle. Do you see some of these groups starting to plant their flag together, or is this just going to continue being alliances of convenience?
It's both, to put it simply. They're growing together and they're seeing what works for each other and able to train with each other. They're both pursuing the same thing, which is a global caliphate. And they are both manifestations and representative of a lot of the same issues in countries throughout Africa and, in fact, in the Middle East. So it's definitely it is part of the dark side of globalization, and it'll continue to be an issue. And it's not necessarily planting the same flag so much as doing what works in other places for the same cause, but we'll do it our way.
That's a fair point, because I think what a lot of folks do since it's still going on, but with the global war on terrorism, we look at an international movement like Al-Qaeda, and to a fair point, I do this sometimes too. You take transnational movements like Al-Qaeda, global movements like Al-Qaeda, and you conflate them with like what's happening in Mali, what's a very regional conflict. Now, there is some room, like you described, for movement across borders, but we do well to remember that some of these folks that, despite the fact that they are very malicious, is that doesn't necessarily mean that their aims are global. So that's a flaw kind of on our side of the security, or at least my side of the security thinking, is a lot of it does become conflated. We're going to shift this since we're talking about Nigeria. We're talking about Mali. We're going to get Jim more into this conversation. Let's start talking about Nigeria. Start off with you, Zach, is what's the effect, sort of further flesh out what the effect of the rebellion in Mali is having on Boko Haram and northern Nigeria. And then, Jim, we'll start talking to you is maybe how – what's the effect on the government – the effect on corruption, if and how what's happening in northern Nigeria is affecting what we're seeing as the increased level of piracy in the Gulf of Guinea. So, Zach, maybe you could kick it off.
Sure. And just to add to what you were saying before, Mukhtar Balmukhtar, I mentioned him before. He's a great example of this regional, transnational way of understanding Al-Qaeda. he split off from Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb because he was closer to Al-Qaeda Central than he was to the AQIM leadership, and he didn't want to take orders from them, so he started his own organization, and he's been a lot more successful than them to a certain extent. So it does play in. Now, in terms of how it's affected Boko Haram, well, the Nigerian military was in Mali, and at the same time, they were escalating their operations against Boko Haram. Boko Haram switched tactics and have gotten a lot more brutal in the last couple of weeks and last months. And it's forced.
They said switch tactics. Can you describe that switch?
The recent attack on the Maiduguri airport in northeastern Nigeria would be the best one. Mm-hmm. A couple of hundred Boko Haram fighters attacked a Nigerian military base, burned fighter planes and helicopters to the ground, and managed to disappear back into the mountains.
So this is a difference then between their raid form of terrorism in the past, and now these are more conventional forms of attack on hard targets.
Correct, which suggests a certain level of interplay with other regional groups being able to get material and manpower. But it also shows that they're willing to change their tactics when it suits them. This is not the counterinsurgency tactic that the Nigerian military has had to deal with before, but it also points to the fact that Boko Haram do have sympathizers in the government telling them where the Nigerian military is going to be.
That's an interesting point that you bring up, because an issue both with piracy in the Gulf of Guinea and, as you're describing, with the Boko Haram is, in both cases, a problem becomes corrupt government officials giving information to either criminal groups or, in this case, Boko Haram. Now, corruption is a big deal in Nigeria, but and I think perhaps you've already revealed your opinion, you mentioned sympathizers. Do you think the folks engaging with Boko Haram are mostly sympathizers, or is this an extension of that malignant corruption that's happening in the Nigerian government? Are these people being paid off?
Well, look, I don't think it's necessarily monetary payoff. It might be religious payoff as far as they're concerned. They might see Boko Haram as legitimately standing up for Islam and Muslims in the area, and the government having ignored them and left them to their own devices. So less monetary payoff and more spiritual payoff, definitely. But I'd say it would be better to understand them as sympathizers than as plain corruption.
Okay. Now, Jim, let's switch it over to you now.
All right.
Still there, Jim?
Yeah, he's...
We're going to sea.
Exactly. Oh, we're finally leaving the land. So what effect...
I'm on a boat.
Exactly. Don't you ever forget. Jim, does the rebellion in northern Nigeria, is it having an effect on corruption? Is it having an effect on piracy happening in the Gulf? Are there less security assets left to secure? Like we've been saying the whole time, give sort of a framework of what you think is happening in the relation between these two events.
Well, I think you've set it up. You know, in a way, what you have for the Nigerian government is a two-front war. Boko Haram in the north and the criminal gangs responsible for piracy and oil theft in the south. Now, there's very little sort of common cause between Boko Haram and what you'd call this oil theft syndicates. You know, it is Muslim versus Christian, different ethnic language groups as well, and one now that is at least much more, you know, purely criminal and profit-minded than undertaking any sort of religious, or even, there's not even much of an ethnic element to piracy in the Niger Delta as there, you know, had been previously. But that said, you're right. You know, it's kind of both Boko Haram and, you know, communities and insurgents in the Niger Delta both feel that they've been, left high and dry by the government of Abuja. And you know, you sort of have two different manifestations of the same problem.
Is the Nigerian government going to be able to use the conflict with Boko Haram as a catalyst for cracking down on corruption? Obviously, this is an ongoing and endless fight that the Nigerian government has seemingly been unable to get its handle on. Does this existential conflict despite the fact it is very horrifying and very violent, at least give them a narrative in which they can defeat this corruption?
No. Flat out, no. I don't think... I mean, defeating corruption is such a... You know,
broad. I understand. It is very broad.
There's a lot of... Reforming the oil sector in Nigeria is the large part, the root of the problem there, that the country needs refinery capacity that it doesn't have and, you know, makes no sense for it not to have, that it's been producing oil for over 50 years. There, you know, this is, and the way that the subsidies are paid for, you know, Nigeria pays the government pays a subsidy on the price of oil, making oil for Nigerian citizens, purchasing oil in Nigeria is far cheaper than it is elsewhere in the region. So that spurs a lot of the black market for oil trade you have, where it's, you know, stolen, whether it's from a ship or from a pipeline, and sold in a neighboring country. But, you know, when they attempted to remove that subsidy in January 2012, I believe, you had riots on the street. So, you know, that problem is entrenched among the citizenry. And then you also have the problem of corruption in the oil sector, so well entrenched in the political, military, economic elite, that it's very much, I mean, it's a small, low moving pace. And now, you know, we're moving into huge elections in 2015 that are going to sort of throw all this back up. You're actually now seeing sort of the development of what's looking to be a very exciting two-party race in Nigeria.
In the midst of the problems in the Gulf with the oil sector and Boko Haram, in a country that's obviously having problems with stability, both of you, how do you see these elections?
Well,
go ahead.
So, you know, as elections are generally, you know, a north-south affair as they are, and you have Nigerian People's Democratic Party, which has been in power since democracy was restored in 1999, and, you know, they've had their own internal rules that it's supposed to go Muslim-Christian as the standing president, and it's Goodluck Jonathan who's sort of broken that rule himself now, and is looking like he's going to stand for re-election for what will be, he inherited the position when his predecessor passed away in office. So this will be his sort of second and a half term, which has created this huge animosity within his own party. September and October, you had a huge split of seven governors from the PDP, who in fact left to form their own faction within the party. And now most of them have gone over to the side of the opposition, which itself is an amalgamation of the four opposition parties from the last election.
Right. And it's definitely going to be messy. Just to add to that, the last election, if you look at Nigeria, the 12 out of the 36 states have Sharia superseding civil law. And the vote was totally split north-south. The 12 in the north voted against Goodluck Jonathan. The 24 in the south voted for him. But I think it's going to get a little messier, and it's a little less certain now because there are these new political alliances being formed. And in the build-up to 2015, it's going to be very interesting who makes deals with whom and how it all shakes out and resets itself.
The state to watch, too, of those seven governors, six of them were from northern states, so it wasn't a huge surprise, nor would it have a great effect in the election. But one of them is the governor of River State, which is, you know, in the Niger Delta and is the sort of home turf of the oil theft and piracy industry. And both politicians and opposition in the Delta, you know, have their own sway and patronage networks over these criminal gangs, which they've traditionally used to serve various functions in campaign seasons. There's one school of thought now that piracy has actually declined a little bit just in the Gulf of Guinea over the last several months. There have been fewer attempts at tanker hijackings, fewer kidnappings. I mean, there was one 2 days ago, but that was the first one reported in 2 months. And there's a theory that part of this is these militant groups have come together and made a deal that, you know, we want to better benefit Goodluck Jonathan's electoral chances and, you know, are being paid off even more than they already were to sort of keep things calm on the southern front. So you do have, you know, war and politics and criminality all being carried out by other means.
That was actually going to be my question, and you jumped on it already about the political connections. Once this election is over, have we seen, I'll call it peak piracy in the Gulf of Guinea? Is this going to get worse?
I think that's not, certainly not going to get better. The underlying conditions of marginalization in the Niger Delta aren't going to change overnight. What could get a lot worse is, you know, piracy and criminality and insurgency was far worse in the mid-2000s to late-2000s when you had the Movement for Emancipation of the Niger Delta and other groups that were committing piracy and sabotage, not only for the economic gain, but as a way to draw attention of, you know, their campaign against the foreign oil companies and against the central government. And they were all essentially bought off with this amnesty payments that started in 2009. The Nigerian government spends more on these amnesty payments than they do on their national health service, and they're set to expire
in
and they're set to expire in 2015, the same year as the election. And with those
James,
removed,
can I jump in with a question real quick?
Certainly.
Does the Nigerian government pay, does the money go to the, just the MEND leadership or to the MEND organization? In other words, is this going to be a constant cycle if the leadership gets bought off and then the underlings take up piracy again?
That's actually what you've seen. The leadership was, there's sort of degrees of, and the leadership were bought off with security contracts, were the most lucrative form, where they formed security companies where they're now in charge of guarding pipelines or guarding areas for coastal surveillance. And then underneath them, there was originally, I think, 26,000 militants that came in under this program. But when you began to see new forms of piracy emerging in the Gulf of Guinea in around late 2010, a lot of those perpetrators have been deemed the third wave militants who were left out of the first amnesty payments. Or even, you know, it's a, that region has, the Niger Delta is about 60-70% youth unemployment. So even people coming up who are teens now who saw their brothers, fathers, uncles fight in the insurgency, they're now making money, but I'm still without a job. And, you know, the underlying conditions were not really addressed by the amnesty at all. There was some vocational training, some education, but then now you just have people who've been trained, but there's still no jobs.
What kind of effect would you say Sobel's have on this? For folks that haven't heard the term before, it's soldiers by day, rebels by night.
I mean, that's, you're right, it's a big problem of corruption, you know, in the Nigerian naval forces that, you know, they're underpaid. Some of them are sort of rented out as security contractors to foreign vessels in the region, where there's a great concern of either information being passed back to pirate groups, or even some of these people directly, you know, that the putting on your balaclava at night and going back out to sea. And then at the top end of that, you have a lot of allegations and some indictments of high-level current and former naval personnel who have been involved in oil theft as well.
Now, where would you say the split exists in the Navy? Namely, because you see in Nigeria, you see the NNS Thunder sails all the way out to Australia and comes back, which is pretty impressive for a Navy I'm sure that folks don't give much credence to. Between that kind of capability with those sailors with that level of technical capacity to these small groups that are underpaid, that are sold out as security contractors, that might be selling out the operations of commercial vessels going to sea?
Well, it's basically, it takes place at every single level of that chain is how, you know, corruption functions in Nigeria and anywhere else, where it starts at the very, very top and it works its way down to the lowest level. That everyone is basically, you know, copying the precedent that's been forced upon them. And that's why it goes, you know, you had the previous president of Nigeria's wife was, cited in WikiLeaks files about being involved in illegal oil theft and illegal oil trading. And then that goes down to the head of the Navy, you know, to the head of the armed forces, all the way down to your rawest recruits who are just going to try and, you know, make a few dollars simply just selling information. Because that's, you know, that's the system of getting by that's been so deeply ingrained.
So then you would say it's a function of then position is a way of putting it. It's not the different kinds of people. It's not the different types of training. It's not it's purely where you're put. If you're put somewhere in which corruption is an option, it will most likely have already happened and you will become part of it.
Yeah, there's a great proverb that I heard in Senegal that's got me thinking. Is the goat eats the grass wherever it's chained. That, you know, essentially that's it. You're right. What the station is determines, but there isn't, thinking of this as there's, you know, this clean segment of the Navy and this dirty segment of the Navy. It's not really seen as that you're, a bad cop, for example, because you're, you know, have a side business on doing this. You're still protecting, what it is you're, you know, being paid to protect to a degree. It simply is this additional source of income that everyone wants a slice of. Now, unfortunately, I actually have pressing maritime security work in the Dominican Republic. I have to go and catch a flight too. So I have to.
Perfect. Absolutely. No.
I'm going to have to leave you both now.
It's been a pleasure having you, and we'll close out with Somalia with Zach. But Jim, thanks again, for joining us, and have a Merry Christmas. In the Dominican Republic, I guess. Yeah, I guess you're doing Christmas in the Dominican Republic.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, fun times.
I've been back and forth to Canada too much. It's cold. The cold's getting too deep into the bones.
All right, perfect. Well, thanks a lot, Jim.
All right. Cheers, guys. Happy holidays.
Take it easy. Happy holidays.
Well, here we are. We're at the end of the show. We're talking about Somalia. We've got Al-Shabaab. We've got the AU. We've got the TFG, Transitional Federal Government. We've got Puntland. We've got Somaliland. People are familiar with the players. People have read about them. They know the position. I guess two questions I'll ask you. Over the past year, what are the major changes that you think are most important for Somalia? And B, do you ever think there will be a Somalia again? I'll go ahead and plant my flag and say no, there will never be a Somalia again, unless you're referring only to the southern rump.
Okay, well, I mean, that's very interesting. I mean, what do you consider Somalia? I mean, parts that are today held by Kenya and Ethiopia are traditionally Somali and ethnically Somali, and I don't see either of those countries giving that up either. But you're right, since 1991, Somalia has not been really anything. It's been broken up into states with different levels of autonomy, and I don't see it getting better anytime soon. But I think it's going to have to happen. It might not be a safe country. It might not be a particularly, you know, top of where James would like to spend his warm Christmas vacation. But I think it's going to get better. I think Puntland is going to sort itself out. I think the TFG, like it or not, is going to be pressured by the rest of the African forces and the AMISOM forces, which is the African Union Military Intervention Force in Somalia. They're going to try and make a push to make it some sort of country. So whether Somaliland rejoins or not, there will be a Somalia.
By default, you see Puntland as being part of this amalgamation.
I do, and I think it's going to have to take some sort of federated nature, where different states bring different amounts of seats, but they're too similar to not be. I mean, this is a country that really has no right to have problems. If I can go that far, they are very, very similar, and their problems tend to be clan and tribe based as opposed to ethnic based, which is unlike pretty much everywhere in Africa.
Is the problem then going to be, I suppose, when it comes to Somaliland and Puntland, which have their own issues, many of people bring up that stability perhaps comes at the cost of corruption, is you've got these two places that, whatever for their flaws, have been relatively effective at governing themselves. Are they going to be willing to subsume themselves to essentially someone who has been unable to do what they've been doing for several years? Sort of like the 6-year-old coming into the room and telling the two 16-year-old kids now that he is in charge of the show.
Look, I think if the TFG can present it as such as that they'll stop suicide bombings or suicide attacks of any nature, that there will be ramifications for insecurity, that they can turn the lights on, and that they can make the economy run, I don't see why not. The question is will Puntland in particular want to give up its monopoly on charcoal and cut exportation, and whether the rest of the TFG and AMISOM can close out the illegal exportation that's going on at the moment.
So you mentioned cot exports. Now that's pretty openly recognized as a narcotic, but I don't think that the UN has any limitations on it, because I know that UN sometimes gets into drug regulation. Is that on purpose, specifically because of this conflict, that the UN's just looked another way, said, hey, there's a drug trade here. Essentially, that's what it is, but we're not going to get involved because it'll only make things worse and a problem I already don't want to touch?
I think you need to look at the English press. The Telegraph 2 days ago ran a piece about their involvement in cot and Somalis in England. And why, and they're essentially asking why the hell do they want to be stuck with a choice with Al-Shabaab or a narcotic? And that's the way it's been framed in a lot of circles, where either you're going to get these people who are able to make money off of cut and chew cut and be calmed and indulge in their traditional way of life, or you're going to get a modern export in Al-Shabaab, and no one wants to have that conversation.
That's a fair point. Where do we go from here when it comes to Somalia? What do you think the timeline is going to be? What do you think that the hopes are that this conflict will end? Because this has gone on forever. We talk about Iraq and Afghanistan having gone on since 2001 and 2004, but Somalia has for ages been in a state of uninterrupted conflict. The West has gotten involved, Africa has gotten involved. Every decade, it seems, some new force comes in and says, I'm going to solve one of these problems, and then leaves with the problem unsolved.
Right. That's certainly true. And I think it's also necessary to recognize that if you take care of Shabaab, that's not your only militant group that you have to worry about in Somalia. I mean, you mentioned Iraq and Afghanistan, and there are different militias that have different goals with different needs that are very, very active. I mean, you have Hizb Islam, which is another Islam Salafi jihadist group. You have a Sufi group that is Al-Sunnah wal-Jama'ah, which is very, very active there. And just because Shabaab is gone, what's going to make these groups want to be part of the conversation? What's going to make them want to lay down arms and fold into the TFG? So it's going to be very interesting. And I think you talk about leaving when in the middle of an operation, there's no more piracy. So the West has kind of had enough and moving out. And now it's Africa's problem. It's AMISOM's problem. So it's already happened. It's happening again. And we just have to wait and see what happens next.
Looking at all of these issues, is there another domino that's going to fall? And it's sad, too, because for a few years, The Economist noted that Africa was on the upswing, that democracy was taking the foothold, that things were getting better. And now, over the past several years, we have seen this swath of collapses and rebellions. Is there another domino to fall? What is the greatest shining hope for improvement? Sort of give that contrast of those two factors.
Look, I think we should... First of all, I'd have to disagree with you and The Economist who said that Africa was on the upswing. Yes, the economies were getting better. Yes, people were making money. Yes, there was democracy, but only certain people were making money. There was there was the process of democracy without active democracy. You know, there were these democratic.
That's true.
And there were these never really took root, and they were very superficial. And as we're seeing now, really don't count for much because people don't put stock in them. So people are seeing that a lot of things haven't changed. Now, in terms of who's going to get better and who's going to get worse, South Sudan obviously is the easy one that's going to get worse. I mean, they're already attacking each other along ethnic lines. This is a country that is 2 years old and was sort of the darling of the Western media for a while. And hopefully that gets sorted out. But, I mean, that's going to take a level of democratic interplay that I'm just not sure that they're capable of. And if you look further north in Sudan, in southern Sudan and Darfur, that's still not taken care of, and no one's paying any attention to it. But I'd say look at Kenya as a powerhouse. Look at Tanzania with shipping. These maritime ports that are looking towards China for money might just be the next rising stars of Africa.
You know, that is a really good point. You know, in everything that we've spoken about here, we laid. And South Africa has its own problems, of course, but we have laid hands off of Tanzania and Kenya, sort of the rising maritime powers. But something that you noted, and I want to emphasize for the folks listening at home, is that the confluence between democracy and institutions, just because you vote doesn't necessarily mean that you have a stable system. Because remember, a big part of stable democratic government is trust, it's institutions, it's a civil society. And if you, just like Zach and I were saying, if you take a place that has been devastated by a civil war, it's not going to be as easy as giving people a vote. I mean, even if everyone goes in with the greatest of hopes and intentions, there is still a lot of distrust. And if you can't trust other people, then maintaining a democracy is very difficult. So,
absolutely.
That's going to be, like, as we've spoken of in every single one of these cases, it's the inability of all these different players to trust one another. That and some of them are legitimately malicious, so no one should trust them, but still, it becomes a big factor. What's your greatest concern about Africa right now?
Look at all of them. We're in a part of we're in a time, at least, where Western powers who traditionally use money as a way of bailing themselves out and solving the problems don't have money to spend. So there's no outside force coming to take care of it, even if it's in a very superficial way and solving the problem. So things are not going to get nipped in the bud. They're not going to be made better. And these unpalatable dictators who were holding sway in the north are gone. So it's getting worse everywhere. Nigeria is the most populous country in Africa and will hit a billion people in 50 years, is projected by some estimations.
Wow.
With rampant poverty. And they can look at the rest of Africa and say, you know what? We're going over there. And when that happens, what's going to happen to Europe? Europe requires resources from Africa and hasn't been willing to put down the institutions to make sure that Africa, to a certain extent, has the type of democracy, has the type of institutions, has the type of systems that is able to remain stable. So Africa it's the outpost of the war on terror. It's the future of the war on terror, I'm afraid. And it's looking very scary everywhere. Cameroon to Djibouti, I'm afraid. It's a very scary outlook. Not to be so glum about it before Christmas, but it's looking really tough.
You know, I'm glad you couched it in that way, as the frontier in the global war on terror, because we've mentioned that before on the website at Next Wars. When we originally went into Afghanistan and the issue became a power vacuum, if you think that Afghanistan was bad, look at the size and the scope of the power vacuum that could exist and does exist in many places.
I think it's important that you bring that up. I mean, a lot of people are just unaware of how huge Africa is.
Absolutely.
The Democratic Republic of Congo is the size of Western Europe. The United States could fit comfortably into the upper third of Africa. We're not talking small tracts of land here. We're talking huge. And the things that we've seen with groups like Al-Qaeda is they like lawless open lands, which is easy to reinforce, easy to move, easy to slip into the hills. And Africa doesn't have any force, any semblance of a force ready to counter them. And it's very scary.
Absolutely. If you take Afghanistan and you compare it in size, you talked about how the United States could fit comfortably into northern Africa. Afghanistan could probably fit right across the east coast from Ohio to
right.
Virginia, or cover, you know, the Rust Belt, the Midwest, pretty much. So just think about that as that size comparison. And you say that is a small piece of a small piece of a massive piece of territory. So it's a terrifying prospect, but one that we haven't reached yet in my reflections is, while I fear this confluence of all these different groups, is that they are still regionally focused. Now, whether or not that'll change with an influx of, let's say, hardened militants coming from a conflict in Syria or from increased violence in Iraq, looking for other Islamic conflicts to get involved in, who knows where that would go, but it is still a terrifying prospect.
Right. And, I mean, you also bring up two really interesting points in that there is a insurrection going on in Syria, and Somalia and the Shabab's recruits have dried up because of it. I mean, where would you rather fight, in the Levant or in Somalia, in an inhospitable land? And that's really drained their numbers. Now, the second thing, and I'm going to horrify a Navy man such as yourself, but I have been watching a pivot towards Africa while the United States talks about a pivot towards Asia. They're building drone bases in Niamey. They're airlifting troops. And while they're not prepared to put boots on the ground, there is a buildup of American presence and American awareness of what's going on in Africa. And hopefully that'll translate into something substantive.
Well, when you say, you know what, you and I are actually on the same page. I love the Navy. I love the flexibility and I love its ability to forward deploy, but I will not begrudge the Army the fact that it is going to be very important. And I think Americans need to understand too, like we talked about at the beginning of this podcast, folks maybe don't understand how interconnected this global economy is. So when they think of their security, they think of things like the Lockerbie bombing or 9/11, all of which are very true. But it's important not to forget that if you do something like, for example, collapse Nigeria, the effect on the global economy would be devastating. And I don't think we don't look at that as much because it's not as obvious and it's not as visceral, but it's equally as important. So it's whether or not you may not be interested in war abroad, but the wars abroad are very interested in us, unfortunately, because of the way that our global economy is.
Well, I would just add to that Nigeria is a large exporter and the biggest oil exporter in Africa.
Bingo.
And that will definitely have an effect on our economy. If there is trouble there, it will definitely affect us.
You know what? Actually, when you say boots on the ground, we are sending advisors to Uganda. That's been
and training pretty, teams, yeah.
Exactly, training teams. The Coast Guard has been involved in Nigeria and other places doing training with boarding teams. So when you say boots on the ground, we might not be firing rounds down range, but we are getting involved. And I think this is good. I think we're off message a bit when we talk to the pivot to Asia, specifically because we don't need to pivot. We've always been there in a big way. To me, it's saying – a fat guy saying, I'm going to get fat. Well, you're already there, buddy. You don't need to do any work on it. Now, maybe it's an issue of messaging. It's an issue of strategic focus. But the real pivot that we need to talk about is that shift to Africa, because it is, you say, that final frontier. It is in a totally calculating way. It is a massive return on investment there, and when it comes to humanity, when it comes to the ability to build commerce that isn't being realized. If you want to see a boom to the global economy, you want to see success in Africa because of the lack of development there that has continued. I mean, what Africa could accomplish if there was peace, if there was security, is incredible, considering the fact, like, you look at Somalia and you look at the developments that folks have had in mobile banking. So you even in the most horrifying of conditions, people have managed to find a way to innovate and a way to build that commercial success, even if everything around them is in chaos. So if you gave those people some stability, if you gave them some regularity, then hopefully things would change. Zach, do you have any last observations? Uh-huh. Do you have anything that you want to plug? Maybe some places that you write or you're involved in that you'd like us to go look at?
Absolutely. Please come look at the Long War Journal. It's a fantastic website keeping track of the war on terrorism, wherever it may be. I will be your Africa guy. We do great coverage of Sinai, Afghanistan, Iraq. Come check us out. We have articles every single day. Daily updates from around the world, and we really appreciate readers checking us out.
Absolutely. So everybody head out to the Long War Journal. Do you have a Twitter account?
Sure. I am ZIMM_10, ZIM10.
ZIM10. Perfect. Well, Zach, thanks for joining me. Everybody, remember, this is the SimSec Sea Control Podcast, and we are available on iTunes and Stitcher Stream Radio. And I suppose Xbox Music, but Zune is dead, so even I don't use that anymore, unfortunately. You can find us at SimSec, C-I-M-S-E-C, and of course you can email me, the director of the Next War blog, at Next War, N-E-X-T-W-A-R, at simsec.org. We're always open to new material. Zach, it has been a pleasure. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me, Matt.